Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new here, hi, welcome. My name's Georgia, and on my platforms here on the internet, I focus on mostly unsolved true crime. One of the things I'm most passionate about in the world of true crime is reuniting unidentified people with their names, with their families. I truly believe that no one should be buried without the most simple of things, your name, the first thing you're given when you're born. It shouldn't be taken away in death. Today I have a case for you from here in the UK, that of a woman known only as the Wembley Point Woman. For 19 years now, she's been nameless, but investigators believe they are close to a breakthrough. This case is close to being solved. They just need the final pieces of the puzzle. She's buried today in Carpenter's Park Lawn Cemetery near Watford in a common grave with no name. Investigators are dedicated to getting her name on there, to reuniting her with her family, with new information about this case still being released as of just last year, 2022. But this story began on the morning of the 29th of October 2004, when a woman wandered into Wembley Point, an office block between Wembley and Harlesden in northwest London, just a stone's throw away from Stonebridge Park Station. Today, Wembley Point is the WEM Tower or the WEM Tower, an innovative apartment block, but back in 2004, this was a 21-storey office building, one of the tallest in the immediate area. I mean, this building definitely stands out on the skyline. If you're looking for a tall building, that's going to be one that you're going to notice. But unless you work there, you don't really have much of a reason to visit it. Just before 9 a.m, people were working their way into the building to start their workday when some noticed a visibly distressed woman in the lift. According to Samira Sheckle's reporting for The Guardian, a couple of passengers recall her because of how upset she was. One male witness would tell investigators that he told her to cheer up, love, it might never happen, a sentence which fills me with blind rage because I'm sure every woman has been told something along those lines at least once in their life. I mean, I remember after I lost my nan a few years ago, I was upset and a passing man in the street said that exact line to me. I wanted to scream at him, it has happened, it's unhelpful, unwanted, why must I look outwardly happy to please the men around me? I've never heard a woman utter a similar sentence to me, and tell you what, even if I wasn't upset before, that single sentence has the power to fill me with blind rage and now I am upset. I say this to say, this woman is going through a hard time. She's clearly distressed and upset. Instead of asking her if she's okay, she's told to just cheer up, it might never happen. She is dismissed. Maybe if somebody had actually taken the time to take Jane Doe to one side and ask if she was okay, ask if she needed any help, I wouldn't be sat here today telling you this story. But whatever had upset Jane Doe had already happened, and it seems that after this point, she was beyond the point of no return. Jane Doe caught the lift all the way up to the 21st floor, which was a canteen for the workers in the building. From what I can gather, it wasn't technically open to the public, but security was quite lax, so if you wanted to go to this canteen, you could. Not that anyone would really want to go to the top floor of an office building to sit in a workplace canteen if they didn't work there. You probably wouldn't know about the canteen unless you were very familiar with this building. Jane Doe got up there, she bought a coffee and sat in a corner seat alone, reading a copy of The Guardian dated that day, so the 29th of October 2004. It's thought that she bought the paper with her because there was nowhere in the building to purchase it, but it may have already been on the table when she arrived there, but there's no way of knowing. Witnesses then say, calm as anything, Jane Doe stood up, opened the window next to her and jumped out. She didn't make a commotion, people barely registered what had happened. She was just suddenly gone, with the window left ajar behind her. All witnesses agreed that they didn't recognise Jane Doe, they'd never seen her in the building before, so she likely didn't work there. And this has raised many questions over the years. Most high-rise buildings like this have safety locks on the windows to avoid this exact situation, people either accidentally or purposefully falling out of the windows. How did Jane Doe know that these particular windows wouldn't have such locks on them? Again, she likely was familiar with the building. Unless, of course, this was a split-second decision. She was sat there reading her paper and she just decided to jump. She got, for lack of a better word, lucky that these windows opened all the way. Police were called to the scene and shortly after they were able to retrieve her body. She had fallen into the River Brent down below. Now there's very limited information about this case online. Her cause of death on Doe Network just states jumping from a window, so I'm not sure if it was the impact that killed her or if she drowned in the river, but I suppose that's not all too relevant. What is relevant is her remains were completely recognisable at the time of recovery, which makes it all that more frustrating that no one has recognised her in all these years. Jane Doe didn't have a single identifying document on her, no wallet, bank cards, no driving licence. She didn't have a phone or even any house keys. There was nothing that could assist in identification at all. The question has always been whether or not that was intentional, but no note was left behind suggesting that she wished to remain unidentified, and she did also have some very strange objects on her. Jane Doe is estimated to have been between 20 and 40 years old. She was a black woman, Doe Network states her race as Afro-Caribbean, 5'1 to 5'3 and of a thin build. She had short black afro hair described as frizzy in reports from the time, but I suspect they just didn't know how to explain black hair texture. She also had brown eyes and no distinguishing marks or features. At the time of her recovery, Jane Doe was wearing a maroon bomber jacket from an unknown brand in a shiny or plastic appearing material. She had on a single black leather glove on her right hand, a black thin material polo neck jumper, and a claret crew neck jumper over the top of the polo neck. On her bottom half, Doe Network states that she was wearing black slacks and black casual trousers, which is very odd because who layers trousers? But Okay International just state the black trousers with black tights underneath. Jane Doe was very much layered up for the cold weather. She also wore black Skechers boots with a zip and buckles on the side. She's described as well-groomed and smartly dressed. It doesn't seem like, from the outside at least, like this woman was homeless and or unemployed. We are talking purely on aesthetics here, but she seemed like she did have stability. She had a home and a job, a means to wash, a means to buy decent enough clothing and jewellery. This suggests there are people out there who maybe had a tenant suddenly disappear, assuming she was renting, which is the likelihood in London, or there is someone out there who had an employee who suddenly just stopped turning up for work. Speaking of jewellery, Jane Doe had on two rings, a white or silver metal ring on her ring finger on her right hand in a cowrie shell shape, and a silver ring on her left hand little finger. She also wore a stud in her right ear and had on a watch with a black strap and silver face. Although not included in the listings, photos of her jewellery also show what looks to be a faded gold hoop earring as well, that I can only assume she was wearing in her other ear. I don't have a clue as to why that's not detailed in any of the listings when it's very clearly in the photo. Maybe it was found in a pocket, I don't really know. That was all that was found on her person, but she left a few more clues at the table up on the 21st floor. There was a 7-day bus pass that had been issued just 3 days earlier on the 26th. She'd bought it at 7:07 a.m. on Seven Sisters Road in North East London, 10 miles away up in Finsbury Park near the Emirates Stadium. This added just another layer to the mystery of her identity. Clearly Jane Doe knew Wembley well enough to know to head to this building, but buying a ticket that early in the morning in Finsbury Park potentially suggests that that is the area she was from. Maybe she was buying it on her way to work first thing. She also bought a 7-day ticket, suggesting that at the time she wasn't intending to end her life in 3 days. They also found £5.20 in cash, that copy of The Guardian she'd been reading, and an empty packet of Marlboro cigarettes. Some sources say witnesses reported seeing her light up the last one as she sat at that table. There was a black carrier bag with clear lettering on, CPNY, which is believed to be from a London-based chain of shops called Central Park. They had branches in Ealing, Enfield and Tottenham. Very confusing, not from New York. It's not clear what exactly was in that carrier bag. I don't know if that's what held the cigarettes and the money, but it was definitely there. But most bizarrely of all, they found a full 60 by 30 centimetre oil painting. Hauntingly, the painting actually seemed to reflect Jane Doe's current unidentified status. Now, it's really unclear to me from the sources whether Jane Doe was holding the painting as she fell, or if it was just found next to the table she was sat at. But in the centre of the frame of this painting is a figure with no face. Where the face should be, there's just a white blank space, framed by some kind of black and white striped head covering. Experts have said that the painting is tribal in style, with underneath the black space there seems to be the top half of some sort of tribal mask. Around the figure is the depiction of a number of black people. On the left there are faces and on the right figures. I see a pregnant woman and a number of different body parts. I don't know how good a job I'm doing explaining this. My YouTube viewers may be able to see the painting on screen, but if you're listening to this via my podcast, I would urge you to go and look it up online. Just search Wembley Point Woman Painting. Many experts have said that this painting is going to be the key to identifying Jane Doe. It's entirely unique and raises a lot of questions. Why was she carrying it around with her? Why was it important enough to have at her death scene if this was indeed pre-planned? Surely it must have held some sort of personal significance, especially if she was clutching it as she fell, like some sources said. I find myself wondering if maybe it was painted by somebody close to her, the only remaining memory she had of a certain person. In the early days after Jane Doe's recovery from the river, investigators waited for somebody to come forward claiming a loved one was missing. They shared her picture in the hope that someone would recognise her, but there was nothing, just silence. Apparently not a single person in London, in the UK, recognised her. However, I say this having not heard of the Wembley Point woman or Jane Doe before this point. Someone requested her case for an episode and I looked into it, and this is the first time I'd heard of it, and this is my job. I research these cases for a living. So it can't have been that her face was on the breaking news every day. There may well be someone out there who would recognise Jane Doe, they just don't know her story. Maybe somebody who wouldn't be close enough to report her as missing, but somebody who would recognise her. I mean, we run into people like that every day in life. The cashier in the corner shop, the barista who makes your coffee every morning, a neighbour you nod to every once in a while, just people on the periphery of life. They'd recognise you, but wouldn't necessarily notice if you went missing. I couldn't find loads of information about the investigation in those early days. I don't know exactly what lengths investigators went to here. However, I do know that in recent years, this case has been picked up by Locate International, a team of trained community volunteers and university students who review and investigate unsolved missing person and unidentified remains cases, and it was founded in 2019. Locate International have successfully been able to identify several unidentified people in the 4 years since their inception, and the number of volunteers on their books has grown rapidly. According to Samira Shackle's article for The Guardian, this case was brought to Locate's attention by Emma Tilley, who at the time of writing the article was completing a PhD on unidentified bodies at Staffordshire University. Locate then allocated some volunteers to the case, they requested the coroner's report from the Met Police and records for all the interviews they did in the investigation, and the Met denied their request. So all Locate have to go on is the information available to the public, aka all the information that I've been able to share today in this episode. The Met won't give them anything more. It is baffling to me because the Met certainly don't seem to be doing anything themselves to try and solve this case, and you've got people here who are willing to put in the time and effort for free, and they're not willing to let them do that. Or actually, I should clarify, they are allowed to do it, they're just not being given any extra assistance in terms of just the records. Forensic artist Hugh Morrison created an updated image of Jane Doe that the charity have been circulating, along with the photos of the possessions she had with her at the time of her death. As Locate founder Dave Grimstead said to the BBC in October 2022, what's unusual in this case is they do know the answer to most questions. They know how Jane Doe died, they know where she died, they just don't know who she was. The charity are looking for people who worked at Wembley Point at this time. Even if they may not have seen anything that day, they may still have information that could help. Companies such as Loot, TNS, Loud and Clear Mental Health Advocacy, and the American University in London, they were all there in Wembley Point at this time. The Tower also used to host art exhibitions, and they're keen to hear from anyone who was involved in those. They did track down the people who ran said exhibits to see if the oil painting meant anything to them, maybe it'd been bought at the building, but it didn't. Locate have also reached out to art schools in Seven Sisters, where it's assumed that Jane Doe may have lived, to see if anyone remembered selling the painting, or maybe even remembered selling the paint or the canvas. But they were almost two decades late at this point, so the chances of finding anything helpful was incredibly slim. They probably knew that going in, but it's worth a try. You've got to ask the question. This is also where it's frustrating only having the publicly available information, because they only have the photos of the oil painting that I've been able to share here. They don't have anything more than I have. So they don't know if there are any signatures, any marks, anything on the back of the painting that could help them. They have nothing. HR managers who worked in Wembley Point at this time and may have had an employee who suddenly stopped turning up for work in late October 2004, or maybe had somebody suddenly stop claiming their pay, are also asked to make contact with Locate. Now, I do suspect that Jane Doe didn't work in the building herself. I think that surely somebody would have noticed if an employee suddenly stopped turning up, and maybe they would have made the connection to the Jane Doe. It seems wild to me that they wouldn't make such a connection. But I do suspect that Jane Doe had some sort of connection with the building. Perhaps she used to work there, perhaps she was a contractor there, so maybe she was a cleaner or an ex-chef or something, I don't know. Maybe she had a relative who worked there. There is a reason why she chose that building. She clearly knew what she was doing. No one who spoke to Jane Doe that morning recalls her having a foreign accent of any kind, but she wasn't exactly in a very chatty mood, so she didn't say much to people. I do usually say in these episodes, if you don't recall somebody having a noticeably foreign accent, then they probably didn't. But that only really works when somebody is speaking full sentences or if you have an actual conversation with them. Jane Doe may well not have been from the UK, which perhaps could explain why no one has ever come forward saying that she is missing or identifying her. The oil painting to me screams African, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she herself was African, but she was black, so that definitely could be a possibility. The sad truth of this case, that Jane Doe was a black woman, and that probably did affect the investigation that she got. We don't know what kind of investigation was really done at the time, but there was a lack of police resources within the Met, and a long history of institutionalised racism. They likely wouldn't have spent much of their very limited resources on Jane Doe. The fact that I can't find any details of this investigation, and neither can the Locate team, suggests that it was minimal. The Met declined to comment on this to The Guardian, saying 2004 is a long time ago, and the officers who would have looked at this case would either have moved on or long since retired. And that's that. That's all they gave. I know some of you will be wondering about genetic genealogy in this case, and I always feel like a broken record, but as I always say when talking about UK unidentified people cases, genetic genealogy simply isn't licensed to be used here in the same way it is in the USA. There are reasons, I'll link the government document down below if you want to go take a look. But I will say the document is from 2020 now, so it is a little bit outdated, it probably is due review, but as it stands, genetic genealogy just can't be used in this case. They do check the DNA against their own databases, but I don't even know if that was done in this case. Wembley Point woman's case went cold soon after it happened, and it may have stayed that way forever if it weren't for Locate International. I do wish the Met would share their documents with them. It doesn't look like they're willing to work on solving this case themselves, but for whatever reason, they won't share the documents. Locate could potentially solve this though. They are asking anyone with any information to contact them through their website, and I'll leave that linked down below. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.